I am going to pull up my notes and start talking about GiveWell. So the first session is GiveWell and GiveWell's top charities. So just as a quick refresher, GiveWell is an organization that tries to find the charities you can give to do as much good as possible with your dollar. Specifically, we focus on organizations that are doing proven, cost-effective, and scalable work. So generally look for really strong evidence of effectiveness. We generally work on organizations fighting poverty, helping the worst off. We also look for good bang for the buck. So, and that's actually why we tend to focus on the worst off. We look for ways to do a lot of good with a little money. And we look for organizations that are very kind of scalable in the sense that if you write them a check, they will do more stuff. So someone, you know, giving out bed nets, we make sure that if they get more money, they'll give out more bed nets. These criteria are really optimized for individual and in some sense casual donors, in the sense that, you know, if GiveWell was originally started when Ellie, my co-founder, and I wanted to give to charity, and we were in the position of saying, you know, we have full-time jobs, we want to give to charity, we only have a few hours to decide where, we wish there was a helpful guide. And if that's the position you're in, I think GiveWell gives you something where, you know, we've really gone over the evidence, we've looked at things from every angle, we've published all the details to our website, and so you can give confidently to GiveWell's top charities, and that is really the goal of it. The thing I'm going to talk about next session takes a contrasting approach. So it's the Open Philanthropy Project, and it's more focused on serving people who might be kind of like full-time donors in a sense. And it is much more interested in kind of very high risk and very long-term giving, but that's not what GiveWell does. GiveWell is about things that we can make a confident and transparent and public case for. So that's kind of the difference in philosophies between the two. And so the main thing I'm going to do in this first little session is talk about our top charities. You know, for several years we've had the same list of top charities. There's four of them: Against Malaria Foundation, SCI, GiveDirectly, Anywhere in the World, and I'll get to more later. But it's, you know, for several years we've kind of been looking for more top charities to add to our list, at the same time as updating and making sure we're staying caught up on everyone, and then no one stays on the list who shouldn't. And you know, this year, for the first time in several years, we did add three new top charities. So we went from four to seven. And now we have, you know, quite a larger number. And so instead of going by charity, I'm going to try and organize this going a little bit by intervention, because a lot of our top charities kind of do the same thing. And then I'll talk about the big picture, just like how this year is different from past years, things like that. But I'm first just going to give a summary of what our top charities are, what they do, what the news is on them, and then I'll, you know, give some big picture thoughts and take questions. So starting off with cash transfers. So GiveDirectly is an organization that their basic mission is for every dollar you give them, they are going to get about 82 cents to people with extremely low incomes by global standards. So this is often a matter of going to, you know, the poorest parts of Kenya that they can find, and, you know, furthermore, kind of looking at the people who have, who do not have a metal roof, who have, let's say, a mud thatch roof. And so they're really trying to zero in on the lowest income possible people and just give them cash using this mobile money system where people kind of store their credits on a SIM card. And the basic thinking is, you know, there's a couple of reasons this is attractive. One is you're making your money go as far as possible by getting it to people that it will mean a lot more to than it does to you or anyone else. And, you know, another key philosophy behind cash transfers is that it's about empowering the people you're trying to help. It's about, instead of, you know, us saying, this is what you need, we're saying, you know, we have more wealth, we're going to ameliorate that to some degree, transfer the wealth, and then people can decide what they want to do with the wealth. So it's kind of all about empowering and leaving the decisions up to them. This is an intervention that I think just instinctively makes a lot of people really uncomfortable. Personally, if I had never heard of charity, I would probably guess this would be like the first thing someone would have tried as a charity. But in fact, it's kind of the last thing. It's kind of a new weird thing that that has become more of a topic in giving circles and development circles recently. And it's a new organization, only a few years old. It's younger than GiveWell. And, you know, I think that's pretty interesting. I think a lot of people kind of have a couple intuitions about why it's not a good idea to do this. I think a lot of people are afraid the money's being spent on, you know, let's say alcohol and entertainment. A lot of people just think, is that really the best you can do? Just give cash to people? But, you know, cash transfers, actually partly, I think, because of the skepticism, have been one of the most extensively studied programs out there in the development world. And I think the results are actually pretty encouraging. People have looked very hard for negative effects, for signs that a lot of the money is going to alcohol or things like that, cigarettes. Haven't really found it, have generally found that people spend the money in a variety of ways. A lot of times they might invest it. You know, buying livestock is an example of something someone might do if that turns out to be a good thing for them to do that can help them earn more in the future. Or fixing their roof so that they don't have to, or getting a metal roof so they don't have to constantly spend money fixing their roof. Or just buying more food and having better nutrition. And so, you know, the studies that exist, I think, have been pretty encouraging about the effects on people's lives, about the investment returns people get, and we think this is a good intervention. We do think you can probably do better according to our best estimates. The other charities I'm going to talk about, when we try to calculate it all out, it looks like they're doing significantly more good per dollar spent. But if we're wrong, if our calculations are bad, I think GiveDirectly is a pretty good deal. And I think especially for people who are especially skeptical, skeptical of studies, skeptical of calculations, skeptical of evidence, this is a nice simple intervention. I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think your money can do, you know, really an enormous amount of good because the people are at very low incomes. So $1,000 might take sort of like an entire family and be a year's income for them. And they get it all at once, which gives them opportunities to invest and to kind of pull themselves out of situations that they rarely get. So it's actually can be quite transformative, and it is quite a great return on your charitable giving, in my opinion. And so, you know, the update on GiveDirectly as an organization, they remain the strongest organization, I would say, of our top charities, just in terms of, like, they have really excellent monitoring. We really understand what's going on. They're great at collecting data. They're self-critical. They're transparent. They've studied themselves. And they're scaling really successfully. So, you know, in the next year, they could easily spend tens of millions of dollars this way. There's very little doubt that they can absorb whatever money people choose to throw at them. And so I would say this is the top charity with the least room for doubt that you are doing a lot of good if you give there. Next up is, you know, kind of, one more comment on GiveDirectly. They have been ambitious in a certain way, which is that they've often combined what they're doing with other things. So they, you know, almost all, or I think all, of the cash transfers they give are done as part of experiments, where they might try two different ways of giving cash transfers and see which one is better. They're working on a partnership where they're going to be testing a more traditional charitable intervention against cash and kind of promoting this idea of cash as a benchmark, that if you're helping people, that's not good enough. You need to be helping people more than if you just gave them the money that it costs to help them. So I think they do a lot of cool things, and I think they've been very successful, and I think they're probably gonna downsize a little bit this year just because they have been raising a lot of money, and I think it's not gonna be quite as much this year. So definitely plenty of room for more funding there. Next set of charities is deworming charities. So there's a set of parasitic infections that are extremely common, especially in Africa, also in India. These are the, you know, roundworm, whipworm, hookworm, and then this worm called schistosomiasis. And, you know, what we know is that a large, large number of school children are infected with these worms. What we don't really know is how that affects them. We have, you know, there's very little in the way of like solid clinical symptoms of having a worm infection. If you get a severe infection, you start to show symptoms and you generally go to a clinic and you can easily get treated for it. The question is, what do you do with people who have kind of mild or ambiguous or not clearly symptomatic infections? And deworming is the process of going around and basically treating children with drugs once a year generally or something like that that kill the worms. And so you treat everyone whether or not they have worms. You don't bother to test them because that brings the cost way up. The drugs have very few side effects. And then the question is, what does this do? Well, it definitely kills the worms. Does this help people in any measurable way? And that is the subject of a massive debate. And so if you Google worm wars, you'll see just like economists getting very angry at each other. A lot of people getting angry at us. Us hopefully not appearing angry when we write about it. And, you know, the bottom line, or how I would summarize the word more, is really quickly, and there's a lot more depth to it. There's a lot of short-term studies, and they really can't pick up much of anything. In terms of weight gain, in terms of better iron content in the blood, in terms of anything with test scores, basically in aggregate, you see almost nothing from short-term studies of deworming. And then there are long-term studies, very, very few studies. And the studies have significant flaws, significant problems, and they find amazing effects. And so how do you put together all that evidence and decide how you feel about deworming is something that we have put a lot of effort into. Certainly in the past, we've picked apart a lot of studies. We've gotten their raw data. We've gone through it ourselves. We've looked for all the issues. I think, you know, one issue we've really harped on that I think doesn't get enough attention is that the best study on long-term impacts of deworming, the deworming took place in one of the most worm-heavy areas, and it was in the middle of El Nino, where there was a massive amount of flooding and worm infections went to totally unrepresentative levels. And so anyone extrapolating from that study, I think, needs to be more careful than they usually are. So we definitely have lots of reservations. This year we got even deeper into it. So David Rudman, who works for us, is, you know, kind of, he's a person who wrote like an entire book about the evidence behind microfinance, and he tends to go very deep. And he, you know, took the deworming studies, got the data, and just like replicated everything himself, subjected it to a million sensitivity analyses. The bottom line is one of the studies that was encouraging about deworming, we no longer believe. Another study we think is like still got a lot of problems. It's the El Nino one, but it has stood up to his scrutiny, which I think is pretty impressive for a study. And so, you know, our position on deworming is basically the same as what it's been, which is that I would probably guess it's more likely than not that deworming actually doesn't have any substantial impact on people's lives, because we're just working with a really thin evidence base. But if it has the kind of effect that you've seen in those studies, it's an unbelievable deal for your money. It's 50 cents or a dollar per kid per year to deworm someone. And so when you net all that out and you look at it, we end up thinking that deworming is about a 5 to 10x better deal than cash transfers in terms of how much good you're accomplishing per dollar. And you can measure that in terms of, you know, you deworm someone, they make more money later in life. How does that additional money compare to the additional money you could have just given them that they could have then invested? I'll take questions in a minute. And so, you know, our take is that when you net all that out, deworming is, you know, looks better than cash transfers, maybe 5 to 10x, and looks about as good as the malaria interventions that I'll get to. And so then in terms of the organizations that do deworming, there's Deworm the World, there's four of them. So two of them are new this year, or, you know, new to our list. There's Deworm the World, which is our favorite in terms of the cost effectiveness, which is generally a function of how many worms there are where they're working, and our favorite in terms of their monitoring reporting, but they're the ones with the least financial need. Basically, it's not clear that they need any money, and if they do, it's not a huge amount. And then there's Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, a group we've recommended for a long time. Historically, we've really struggled with them. We've really had a lot of trouble communicating with them, not felt the quality of the reporting was high. We think they've been improving. So I wouldn't say, you know, I wouldn't say A plus still, but I think they've improved a lot. And we now think they're kind of second out of the deworming charities in terms of our confidence, and they have a lot of room for more funding. Then there's Site Savers, which is new to the list. They're a group that does a whole bunch of programs that are focused on preventable blindness and vision issues. They have a new deworming program, and based on their past non-deworming programs that are similar, we feel confident enough in them to recommend them, but we're gonna need to follow them for longer before we really understand everything they're doing as well as we do the first two. And then the End Fund, I would say, is a similar situation where, you know, they do a bunch of programs with neglected tropical diseases. Some of that is deworming. We think they're, you know, good enough to recommend in terms of the evidence we've seen, but it's going to be a couple of years before we have the same level of confidence in them. And so then the final category of charities I'll talk about is malaria prevention. So one of them, our kind of one of our top charities for a long time has been the Against Malaria Foundation. They distribute bed nets with insecticide on them, and those hopefully block and kill mosquitoes and prevent people from getting malaria. The main benefit of this is preventing deaths of children under five. if that's something you're excited about, you should be excited about this. If you don't value that, as some people, you know, have conflicting opinions on this, you may want to give to another charity. There are other benefits to preventing malaria, but that is the main one. And AMF is, you know, is a good organization. We've been working with them for a long time. They have better reporting and monitoring than by far any other BedNet organization. This year, they expanded a lot. They signed a lot of new deals. We got a little bit less confident in their monitoring. They have a massive funding gap. So in theory, they could use something like $80 million plus dollars. I do think the more they get, the more the cost effectiveness falls a bit, because you start getting into the possibility that they're pushing out other BedNet donors, like governments, and especially because they have a preference for doing like really big distributions, they'd have a preference to do a whole country. But we still think they're excellent. And then there's another group, Malaria Consortium, which does not do BedNets. They do seasonal malaria chemo prevention. And that is, it's almost kind of like a hybrid of BedNets and deworming. It's drugs to prevent malaria for young children under five. And it's like if you travel and you take drugs to prevent malaria, this is that same basic thing aimed at people who are especially vulnerable. And so Malaria Consortium, actually kind of a similar, you know, that thing we think the evidence base is not quite as good as BedNets, but it's kind of similar. The cost effectiveness is not quite as good, but it's in the ballpark. And overall, these malaria groups, we would say the evidence is stronger than for deworming. It's not as robust as cash transfers. And we think the cost effectiveness is like maybe a little worse than deworming, but very close, and a lot better than cash transfers. So that is our seven top charities. We also recommend a number, not recommend, we list a number of other charities that are noteworthy in various ways on our website, but I've been going for a while and I'm not going to get into that. The two big kind of takeaways to just note are, you know, one, we put more time and we were able to do more on finding new top charities this year than in the past. And we think they have a lot of room for funding, and also Good Ventures, which is the major donor we work with, is giving $50 million total. But they're not giving more. And I can get into why that is. I will certainly talk a lot about that at the next session, but that leaves a really massive amount of funding gap. And so there's really a lot to give this year. There's kind of no practical limit to how much they can absorb relative to how much they have room for. And so that's, you know, that's kind of where we're at. And those are the big updates this year. And with that, I'll take questions for a bit. I'm just gonna get that out of Kleenex. Oh, and I'm going to repeat the questions just for the recording. Yep?
When you said deworming is 5 to 10 times more effective, is that contingent on you thinking it's effective, or that's adjusted for
That's adjusted. Yeah, so when I say deworming looks 5 to 10x better than cash, that is adjusted for the fact that we have a lot of skepticism about the evidence. So if we took the evidence at face value, it might be something like 100x or more. Yep.
The Malaria Consortium that I know, it does a lot of things beyond chemo. It's sort of like a general sort of malaria advocacy
yep.
kind of organization that works with ministries of health. So how would you, are you recommending like a sort of a restricted donation to them? Or
yeah,
why,
so for...
Like how, what's this link between this kind of relatively uncommon intervention and this big organization that does a lot of things?
Yeah, Malaria Consortium is a big organization that does a lot of things. The same is true of all three of the new top charities, so SiteSavers and EndFund. None of these are focused entirely on the program we're recommending. In all cases, we're recommending donations that are earmarked for that program. And we do believe that those donations will cause that program to expand more than it would otherwise. That's definitely something we've checked out. Oh, I should make one more comment about the top charities. Just a good thing to just like know on the progress on GiveWell front. I was like basically not involved this year in any of the research. Kind of came in at the end and, you know, played with the cost effectiveness file, but didn't really have anything to add. Basically everything that I gave you just now is mostly from like reading our website, or basically all of it. But before I came here, I was just like on our website making notes. So I think that is a good step. Like that is good progress for GiveWell as an organization. That I'm definitely unnecessary now. And also another reason for you to know that is that there will be a lot of questions that stump me tonight. So that's a warning. Yeah. Yep.
Is the expansion in the number of top charities something that you expect will continue?
Is the expansion in the number of top charities something I expect will continue? Well, we're definitely not going to double our list every year for very long. But I do expect new top charities next year, not for sure, but that's something I'm going to get to. I'm going to take a little, you know, interlude and talk about that. But we, in addition now to recommending top charities, we do a fair amount of work trying to help facilitate the emergence of new top charities. And we're starting to call this the incubation program. We used to call it GiveWell Experimental. And so there's a bunch of groups right now that actually we have recommended grants to them, like from the major donor we work with, that are trying to help them cross along that path to get to a top charity. Some of that is for research, some of that is for charities themselves, and there are a couple that I think are like reasonably likely to get on that list either next year or the year after. I don't think there'll be three new ones next year, but there might be. Yep.
Have you ever, or would you ever look not just at donation of money, but actually donation of time, and how could that be the most effective way?
Sure. Do we look at donations? Do we ever look at donations of time instead of money? So GiveWell is just focused. It's got its mission, and the mission is money. The reason we're more focused on money is because we feel that we can have more impact that way. So, you know, I think one of the issues that we do see sometimes with donation of time, it's hard to give general advice on it. Everyone has different skills, and so it's harder to get a scalable recommendation. I will also observe, and we've written about this a couple times, you know, to do really good work for an organization, a lot of times you need to be trained. You need to have context, you need to have experience. And so it can be hard to get a lot of real impact out of like someone who's just donating like a little bit of time, especially if like they're not, you know, if they're kind of changing their mind about how committed they are and if they're not always into it. And so, you know, that's just something to keep in mind. I actually think sometimes when a charity takes on a volunteer, they're really trying to recruit a donor or a fan more than they are trying to get a volunteer. And usually when we, in the past, we don't even take volunteers anymore. In the past, when we've taken volunteers, it's generally just been for recruiting in the hopes that people turn into employees. So those are some general observations on that. I think it's very challenging to figure out how to do a lot of good when you're donating time. And I often encourage, it depends who you are, I often encourage people to just not do it and focus on doing things that they have a huge comparative advantage in. But you know, it's not something we're experts on, and it's just not where we really focus. Yeah.
My understanding is like GiveWell's previous cost-effective effectiveness models. The benefit of saving like a child's life was considered like 36 quality adjusted life years, which was supposed to represent like a whole life,
mm-hmm.
like with some discount date. And now it's been reduced to like 9 years. I guess two questions. Like one is like what factors went into that reduction, and also like does it even if you're no longer saying that a child not dying is worth a full life's worth of quality adjusted life years, like why even use quality adjusted life years as a measure?
Sure.
Like when I convert it to like dollars, like this is what it's worth in dollars.
Sure. So this gets into our cost effectiveness estimate. So this is an observation that, you know, when we're estimating, when I give you these numbers, like X is five times as good as Y, to get to that number, we need to build a model, and the model needs to do things like, well, AMF is saving lives of children under five, schistosomiasis control initiative is helping people earn more 20 years later. Like, how do you even compare those two things? And our answer is subjectively. So we have a spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet asks you a bunch of questions. And some of the questions it asks you are like, how many years of healthy life do you think are kind of like equivalent to one life saved of a child under five? Because some people might think, well, that's a whole life lost. And so that would be like, you know, 30 plus years. And other people would think, well, I don't really think that children of a certain age, maybe under one, have an identity yet, so I don't want to count it the same way, but I do want to account for the suffering of families and things like that. And so, you know, people can debate that all day, but methodologically, and they actually do at GiveWell, but methodologically, just the high level answer to your question is that we have a spreadsheet where everyone can confront these questions, put in their own values, and the spreadsheet will spit out what the upshot is in terms of your values, how you should value the charities compared to each other. When I give you numbers, so anyone can do that. Anyone can go to our website, download that spreadsheet, put in your own opinions, figure out where you stand. When I give you a number that's like 5x, where that's coming from is that all of our staff members who wanted to, including myself, went into that spreadsheet, put their thing in, and then we took the median. And so for particular value, I think that the 9 DALIs figure you're talking about is probably a median of staff. And so that's probably like, some people think that it should count for a whole life and some people think it should count for nothing and some people are really confused and they put a number in between. They do it on purpose. I mean, they're saying, I'm confused, I'm putting 9. So that is methodologically how that works. At the same time, like, the differences are stark enough that, you know, you don't have to trust us completely and you don't have to download a spreadsheet. Like, you can think about how you value lives of children under 5, and if it's something that, like, basically to you seems totally inferior to raising incomes, then I think I've made it pretty clear which way you would go with that. Yeah.
I had 2 questions. One was about earmarking. I had the sense that before you guys thought that it wasn't a good idea. Is there a reason that in this case you actually believe they're not going to reallocate resources?
Yeah.
And another question is about GiveDirect specifically. I always thought that a big part of their value add was the fact that they're doing conditional cash transfer experiments, and they're trying to influence NGO governmental policy. You didn't touch very much on that. Do you not feel like it's a large part of the value added?
Sure. Okay, so first on earmarking, yeah, we've definitely pointed out in the past that, you know, I think it can definitely be dangerous to just, let's say you have a charity that does a whole bunch of different things, and you like one of the things. So you have a charity, let's say they do, you know, vaccines and job training programs, and you like the vaccines and you don't like the job training programs. If you write them a check and you say, only use this for vaccines, I think the default outcome of that, and like a thing that's going to happen a lot, is they will, like, your money won't really have that impact. Like, they will, like, let's say that I'm the charity and next year I want to spend like $10 million on each. So now I'll take your money and I'll put it in the vaccines pile, and then I'll take other money that I have flexible and I'll shift it over to the job training pile. So that, I think, is something you have to watch out for. Why are we recommending earmarking this year? I don't actually have an answer. This is something I just don't know, except that, like, I believe we watched out for it and questioned, you know, questioned the charities enough. You know, certainly there are things you can do. Like, you can just say, how many treatments are you going to deliver next year if you don't get any more funding of any kind? How many are you going to get if you get this much restricted funding? And then we can hold them to that based on how much comes in. So that's what I'm guessing the basic MO is. Also, earmarking is like less and less of a problem the more and more you're giving. And so when we're dealing with aggregate numbers tracked by GiveWell, they're going to be in the millions. That's a much harder thing to fudge. I think if someone gives $100 earmarked, like, that's just very likely to be kind of, you know, fungible like that. So those are all guesses, because I this is not something I got into the details of. I think it's pretty straightforward to verify. It's just something you have to verify. On the second question, you know, is a big part of GiveDirectly's value the way that it's influencing the policy conversation, the way that it's making people think maybe we should hold charity to a higher standard? I would say it's definitely a part of their value. I mean, I would say they have, I mean, they get a good amount of buzz in the development economics community, and like I said, I mean, they have a partnership that I don't think is fully announced yet, but it's with a major institutional funder to, you know, explicitly take some common aid program and compare it to cash transfers. So I do think GiveDirectly has an impact on the dialogue. The things that I emphasize when making the case for these charities is the things that are kind of, you know, the least subjective and the easiest to make the case for. And I think especially GiveDirectly, it's already doing pretty well and it's already pretty big. So if you give them an extra $100, probably the main thing to focus on is that 82 of those dollars are going to someone who really needs them. But yes, I do think there are these other kind of intangible effects of GiveDirectly. And I think GiveDirectly is still, even on the margin, I think GiveDirectly is stronger on that than the other top charities. I think they are just way more aggressive about looking for creative, ambitious things to do and ideas to spread. And I think that is an advantage of GiveDirectly. If you like that, it's a reason to give there. Yep.
Have you guys looked into the cataract surgery charities? Because you mentioned the Sight Savers, and so in terms of quality adjusted life years,
yeah.
That's something that makes sense.
Yeah, have we looked into cataract surgery? So a cataract surgery, basically it's, you know, it's a very cheap, simple surgery that can restore someone's vision or prevent them from going blind, and that, you know, that seems like it could be very cost effective. I know in the past we've looked at cataract surgeries and we've just run into the like earmarking room for more funding problem, where it was kind of like, there's a charity, they do a bunch of surgeries, we say, if you get more money, will you do more surgeries? And they say no, you know. But I do think it's possible. Like, I think we're still interested in that, and we're still looking for a way to kind of turn dollars into cataract surgeries. And I think that, I would have to check, but I think that may be a category that is, like, possible for a future top charity. Like, in terms of there may be, I mean, some of these top charity investigations take years. And so there may be groups that are being, you know, investigated right now that, that do that, but I'm not sure. Actually, I don't, Kat, do you happen to know?
I know we published a new report on cataract surgeries this year, and I believe room for more funding was the issue, which you mentioned. So your understanding is about what mine is. But there's a new report out that came out in like August that we published.
Cool. Yep.
So how much influence would you say that Givewell has on the organizations that you guys promote? So can you, are you viewed as like a big enough source of income that you can then say, we think you guys would really benefit from doing the study to test this factor?
Sure. How much influence do we have on the organizations we recommend? You know, I mean, I think just as a first comment, I think we probably wouldn't ask an organization to do a study because we think that usually that's, you know, better done by some other organization or by academics. We might ask them to partner on something. You know, I would say that in theory we could be pretty influential. I think we also have to be careful with how we use that influence. We don't want to turn this into like a bunch of Givewell-run organizations. I don't think that would make them better, and I think that would make our recommendations a lot less credible. So, you know, when we are making recommendations, they're usually just ways to, like, we're basically, I think the main thing we do is we tell everyone how they're scoring on our criteria and why they're scoring that way. And I think that definitely can influence organizations to do things differently. So we've told SCI for years, you know, you are getting a lukewarm recommendation in a sense because of the communications issues we're having and because it's difficult to track where the money's going and it's difficult to understand what you're doing. I think there's been a lot of improvement on that front. Is how causal is that? I don't really know, but I feel fine if it is. And then, you know, on AMF, I mean, we've certainly made it clear, you know, for example, we've said at one point we suspended their recommendation because we didn't feel that they were going to push more money into the field. And we made it clear that we, you know, we were happy for them to make certain kinds of compromises that we didn't think were going to hurt the cost effectiveness of the program in order to get more money spent and in order to get more bed nets delivered. Again, they did end up moving in that direction. So again, in both these cases, I don't think it's clearly causal. I think that these are both cases where it could have been totally independent of us. But it's generally, you know, here's how you're scoring on the three criteria. Here's why. I think with some of our incubation charities, it can even be a matter of like, this program is not very cost effective. Here's one that is. And, you know, they do what they want with that information. And certainly there's, you know, there's a reason to take it into account. Yep.
How do you look at like cost effectiveness and growth? Like kind of immediately you could say AMF, you know, spend X $X million in benefits right now and save some lives, or they could spend that same money for like a marketing budget and increase kind of patients next year.
Sure. Yeah, how do we look at the question of like, should AMF spend the money delivering bed nets, or should they spend the money on fundraising, and then that causes them to bring in more bed nets? I think it's fairly rare, I would say, for fundraising to be a big enough part of an organization's budget that it would have a huge negative impact on our cost effectiveness estimates. So I haven't, you know, there's not charities that are getting like knocked off the list because they spend too much on fundraising. Anyone who's getting this far, generally that's not the issue if they're doing an effective program and things like that. So I would say it mostly hasn't come up. I mean, we're also on the flip side of that, we're not going to recommend a charity whose main value add is fundraising. That's like a different kind of value proposition, and that's not, you know, the thing that we offer as Givewell. So that's basically that. I'm going to also talk now, just for a couple minutes before I take the final batch of questions, about that incubation stuff that I mentioned. So I thought this might just be a good time to mention a little bit more specifics on what we're doing there. So like I said, we're very interested in facilitating the growth of future top charities. We work closely with Good Ventures, which is a major funder. They're interested in the development of new top charities. And so examples of some things we've done, you know, Givewell incubation is not the same. It's different criteria. So Givewell, you know, you need to be proven cost effective and scalable. For Givewell incubation, all that needs to be the case is that we believe that there's a decent chance you're going to turn into a top charity and that this money will help you and that it's a good deal. And so some grants, and that's kind of, for that reason, we use actually a process more similar to the open philanthropy process, which I'll get to. But things we've done there, I mean, there's a group called New Incentives. They do conditional cash transfers. So those are cash transfers that people have to kind of do or prove something to get. And, you know, example, what they were doing is they were trying to get HIV-positive mothers a payment in exchange for provably taking this preventive therapy that prevents HIV from transferring to the child. And so you kind of get a two-for-one because you're getting money to low-income people, and you're also, if you pick the right outcomes, you're getting, you know, getting activities that might help benefit their children. That was a group we supported for a while. We were happy and impressed with how they were scaling up and executing on their program, but in terms of enrolling HIV-positive mothers, we didn't feel that the numbers were not what we hoped they would be, and therefore the cost-effectiveness of the program was not good enough to recommend them this time around. And so now they have been talking about going and doing a different kind of conditional cash transfer, more related to immunization, getting children immunized, and that would score higher. And so we're continuing to support them as they try to, you know, find a way they can do something that's going to qualify to be Give All Top Charity. Another group we've supported this way, so we've supported Evidence Action, which runs the Worm the World initiative. We've also supported the piloting of this group program, No Lean Season. And that is a program where they give people vouchers to go from rural to urban areas in the developing world. And a lot of times what that means is that people find they can earn more money. And then a lot of times in the studies, many people went back to the city the next year without even having a voucher. So that's like a sign that this was actually benefiting them. There is some good studies on this, some good evidence, and we've been funding pilots in the hopes that they will get to the place where they can deliver a lot of it, and we feel like it's going well and we're ready to recommend them as a top charity. That may happen in a future year. Supported a group that works on pneumonia treatment, about $6 million for initial scale-up and, you know, scale-up with monitoring to see how this goes at scale. And then they, you know, are a contender. They may be a top charity next year or the year after. There's another group, Charity Science Health, that was explicitly founded by some people who said, we want to be a Give All Top Charity. Our mission of our organization is to be a Give All Top Charity. They're working on SMS reminders to get people immunized more reliably, and that could be quite cost effective. So that's a group that we, you know, have done some supporting of in the hopes that they will get there. And then there's ID Insight is an example of where we've supported something more along the lines of research and monitoring. So this is a group that they basically help collect data and evaluate programs in the field. And unlike a lot of the other groups that do this, so a lot of the groups that are known for doing studies, they're academic groups. And so a lot of times their interests are different than ours. A lot of times they're more interested in illustrating important academic concepts or in challenging important academic concepts and less interested in, let's say, doing the fifth study on something to make sure that it really works the way we think it did, or on just like seeing whether a program is being delivered the way it's meant to be delivered. ID Insight is an evidence-based, study-based group that does more of that. We've given them general support, and we've been working with them on trying to figure out where they can go and collect better and more data on Give All Top Charities or potential future Give All Top Charities that can help us make better decisions. So that's the incubation work we've been doing, and I also have not been very involved in that, but that's some of the things we do for future top charities. Yep.
And whether or not you think, like, what the strengths and weaknesses to their approach were, for Preacher, who's trying to make this in. And then on ID Insight, I believe they're a for-profit, I could be wrong, but I think they certainly have clients. And just how you handle that in your evaluation.
Sure. So first on Charity Science Health, unfortunately, I don't have much to say about the strengths and weaknesses of their program. I think, you know, I wasn't involved in that intervention report and would have to just like go on the website and see it, but we've certainly written it up. And then on ID Insight, what was your question about ID Insight?
I think that they're for-profit or that they at least have paying clients. And I don't know.
Yeah. I don't think they're for-profit. And I could be wrong about that, but I think they do have paying clients. So they'll go to a charity or, you know, a government or something, and someone will pay them to, you know, figure a specific thing out. Yeah, I guess I would be a little surprised because I feel like this would have come up as a logistical challenge if they were for profit. But it wouldn't necessarily rule it out. It would just, you know, it would mean that the money had to be accounted for a certain way.
You haven't, like, necessarily explicitly figured out, like, the fact that they do take in money from a client, that impacts your decision making.
Oh, we fully, I mean, So, you know, have we looked at the fact they've taken money from other clients? Like, yeah, with any organization we make a grant to, we're always asking the question, all right, what's all your revenue? Where's it coming from? What's all your expenses? Where are they all going to? If nothing changes next year, what are you going to do? If you get more money, what are you going to do? And that's always, and then we can hold them to, you know, that at the amount of money they actually end up getting. And so that's always the basis for our recommendations. So, I mean, yeah, my guess at ID Insight is that they have a lot of specific clients. We want them to evaluate a specific program. We want them to look at top charities and potential future top charities and believe they need more money to do that. Also believe that they could use more like general capacity to just like try things. Yep.
A lot of the top interventions seem to be health based, and could you speak to why that might be on a very broad level?
Yeah, why are so many of our top charities health based? It's definitely true. I mean, I think the nature of our criteria creates a bias in some ways toward the measurable, and health tends to be more measurable than other things. I think some other qualities that, and again, like this is a bias toward the measurable. It's fully acknowledged. I think it is quite logical for someone who isn't spending all their time engaging with questions about where to give to something where there's a case that can be made, and that involves, you know, things that are more measurable. So in some ways, it's like, you know, the idea of dropping your keys and looking first under the lamppost. People often present this as kind of a joke or a fallacy. It's often a rational thing to do. If your keys are sitting in a place where you can see them, that is going to be the quickest way you find them. And so I think it is actually quite rational to have a bias toward the measurable when you're trying to make a tough decision and you don't have the context and the soft evidence to do something a lot riskier. Other stuff about health, I mean, I think that said, I don't think we're sacrificing necessarily much cost effectiveness by going for the measurable, because I think there's a relationship where, you know, health charities, they tend to be doing things that, they tend to be helping people in ways that are very universal and very robust and very generalizable and scalable. And also because we understand things so well and because we're able to study them, you're often able to take the way you're helping someone and strip it down to its essence and get it as cheap as possible and distribute it as widely as possible. So I could do a job training program or I could give out bed nets. But with the bed nets, we've isolated what to do that helps people down to the point where it costs less than $5 a person. So I actually, you know, it's not the case that there's a bunch of global health, or it's not the case there's a bunch of global poverty charities that I think are more cost effective and they just like happen to not meet the criteria. I actually think that our top charities are doing things that are incredibly cheap, partly by virtue of their measurability and understandability, that are effective and you're getting incredible value for the money. And I think that's a common feature of health programs. I think it's, you know, it's also just kind of the case, and we've written about this a couple times in the blog, but you know, we are trying to help people who are far away who we don't know much about. And I think helping with health is something that donors and governments and well-meaning, you know, Western world has historically done pretty successfully. A lot of other things they've historically done really badly. Health is a pretty universal thing. It's a thing that we understand. It's a thing we think we can help with. And I think it is, you know, quite appropriate when trying to help someone that you're not, you know, that you don't really understand. It's quite appropriate to focus on effective things you can do to help. So that's, you know, that's some of the health stuff. Yep.
Are you optimistic?
Sure. Am I optimistic about future technologies? I think you're referring to like future technologies that might help find other ways of controlling these diseases we're fighting. So for example, you know, there's been some press about, and I think there was, there is a bit of material on our website if you Google for it, these gene drives. A gene drive being like a way of intervening in a mosquito population so that you stop the spread of malaria. And that's using kind of like genetic engineering techniques. Am I optimistic? I mean, I definitely think there's a chance that some kind of alternative new tech like this will turn out to be a much better way of fighting these diseases than bed nets. I will say that we have made at least one grant along these lines. Like, we are in favor of it. We are looking for opportunities to help with it where it seems like a good deal and where we can help. And if at any point we believe that bed nets are no longer needed, because it's better to do some other intervention to control the mosquito population, then we will adjust our recommendations accordingly. Yeah.
So where does GiveWell stand in terms of outreach? How are you all kind of spreading awareness about GiveWell? Because I know,
yeah,
you know, if we could get more donors to be looking at GiveWell recommendations, animal charity evaluator recommendations, we would have a more robust influence.
Yeah. How is GiveWell thinking about outreach, and what do we do to spread the word about our own work? It, you know, to date, I've kind of said the same thing, you know, whenever people ask me this question for a long time, and so it may be, you know, I don't know, maybe frustrating to people or something, but for a long time, we've just said our priority is not outreach, our priority is research, because we have to have the good research, and, you know, we're still seeing good growth in our money moved. So we track, you know, we track the donations people give to our top charities, and that, you know, that number has grown pretty strongly every year. We'll see what happens this year. It was in the, you know, last year, including Good Ventures, it was over $100 million, and about 70 of that was Good Ventures, and about 40 million was coming from other people. And actually, for several years, it's been a little bit challenging to even find enough recommendations to take all that money. This year, that's not the case. This year, there's plenty of room for funding. But yeah, I mean, I would say that, like, we've really focused on getting the research done well, and also on getting the research to the point where it doesn't need the founders as much anymore. And that's been our top priority. And so outreach has been a secondary thing. And there also have been other groups that have done, you know, their own outreach efforts. So especially, you know, groups in the effective altruist community, there's multiple of them that are specifically trying to, you know, their mission is to get people to give more to effective charities, which could mean top charities or something else. That's what they focus on. What we focus on is just getting the recommendations right. So I would say that in the future, you know, if we see our money moved slowing, and we have lots of room for more donations, and we're not getting a lot more donations, and we have the organization pretty well under control, where we're able to do quality research without too much reliance on the founders, that may be a time to really ramp up outreach. For now, it's more of a low-hanging fruit thing. So we do, you know, we do the online advertising. Very important part of our outreach is, like, talking to donors and just building relationships with them, getting them more confident in our work. We do give talks, but it's not the main thing that we work on. I take one more question, and then we're going to take a break. Yep.
Does GiveWell look at programs that are designed not to need cyclical funding, like social businesses? Once you fund them, they become self-sustaining by design?
Sure. Does GiveWell look at giving opportunities that are kind of, that can become self-sustaining? We did this a while at one point. So we spent quite a bit of time looking at microfinance, for example. You know, in the time we spent on it, we didn't end up feeling that there's anything really repeatable, scalable, proven there. I think there are definitely times when a small investment up front can create something that then sustains itself and grows. And a lot of times those look like for-profit investing opportunities, and that's great and that's exciting. But I can't point you to any kind of thing where it's like, every time you give $1 million here, you're going to get a self-sustaining thing. And furthermore, I didn't even see anything that looked like I could point to it and say this is a better deal than top charities that was in that category. Because I think, you know, for example, microfinance, I think the impacts on poverty and the impacts on people's lives are just, like, super ambiguous. So that, you know, that's the story there, but it comes back to those criteria. All right, well, we're going to take a break of some amount of time, like
10 minutes.
And then we're going to talk about Open Philanthropy Project. So thanks, everyone.